True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
On July 5th, 2003, 37-year-old Florida bartender Sandra Razzo was shot in her own garage before she could even get out of her car. Sandra, known by her friends as Sandy, was a hard worker, a really good friend, and a devoted mother to her young daughter. The idea that someone would want her dead was really difficult to comprehend. There was one man with a motive, 36-year-old Tracy Humphrey. Humphrey was an ex-boyfriend of sorts, charged with felony battery and the sexual assault of Sandy. He was due to go on trial in August of 2003, and Sandy planned to testify against him. But Tracy had an ironclad alibi. So if he didn't kill Sandy himself, could he have been the mastermind behind her murder? Join us at the quiet end for the silencing of Sandra Razzo, a murder case with an unlikely pair of co-conspirators. It's also a case that begs the fascinating question of whether one person can convince an otherwise nonviolent person to kill. And what have we got for a beer, Dick?
A Florida beer. I really like the Funky Buddha Brewery in Oakland Park, Florida. They make some really great beers. This is kind of a fun one. It's called Sweet Potato Casserole Strong Ale. So it's what's considered a fruit and field beer, 7.9% alcohol by volume. It's an amber-colored beer, small tan head, an aroma of sweet potato, and sweet, sugar. And it has the taste of sweet potato and marshmallow. There's your sweet potato pie. Vanilla and spice also.
It sounds delicious, but it does sound really sweet.
It's very sweet.
Yeah.
To me, it's more of a, like a dessert beer.
Yeah.
And there is such a thing.
Okay. So does that mean you have it with dessert or that's just dessert?
It could be either, but yeah, you could have it with dessert.
Okay, cool. Well, let's open it up. I'm anxious to try this one. I love the name.
I knew you would.
So, Dickie, come meet me at the quiet end. I have had some different thoughts about the quiet end, and I thought, well, maybe if we get really desperate, we could get our old beer-drinking friends from the bar on Zoom so they could be in our quiet end and we could chat with them.
Hey, there's an idea. We'll think about doing that.
Okay. All right. So why don't you go ahead and start this story? It is fascinating, but it really kind of makes you angry. There's a lot of things here that didn't need to happen.
It makes me angry. It really does. So it was 1973. Sandy Razzo's mother, her name was Sandra Poole, she packed up her four kids, rented a U-Haul, and moved to Florida. So what they were doing was running away from Sandy's father when they lived in Pittsburgh. I guess he was not a very nice guy. Her mother had been only 19 when Sandy was born in 1966, and her ex-husband decided that it would be a cool idea if they named her after her mom. So two Sandras were two Sandys.
Right. So the mom, when she cut her name down to Sandy, she used a Y. And then Sandy used the double E. And that's how they differentiated things.
Okay. So we got Y Sandy and double E Sandy.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So growing up, life wasn't very easy for Sandy. But the real trouble in her life began after she met Tracy Humphrey in October of 2000. Both she and Humphrey were 34 years old, working in the same bar, club called Inferno. Humphrey was a bouncer, and Sandy tended bar.
So almost 2 years later, Sandy was sitting inside the state attorney's office in Tampa, Florida, and she was sharing her disturbing and detailed account of what had happened inside her apartment after she befriended Humphrey. According to Sandy, she and Humphrey got together as friends, and they had gone on a couple of dates, but nothing really romantic. She felt that they were pals. Both liked to be healthy and eat healthy and work out. And they did have dinner together a few times or went out for a coffee. Once they even went to Catholic Mass together. But the trouble started when she started saying no to his advances.
Yeah, he was a friend to her, right?
A companion. She almost kind of felt sorry for him and wanted to help him out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think she was really romantically interested, which makes it kind of mind-boggling and sad that she had as much to do with him as she did.
That's what confounds me.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, we do have to think that she did come from an abusive household. So
yeah,
she did have dysfunctional things going on.
She didn't have the good role models and stuff like that.
Right.
It bothers me that someone who seems to be otherwise well put together was hanging out with him.
Yes. He did seem to have a gift for manipulating people.
Well, he must have had to.
So he kept hitting on her, and she told him they could still hang out. But anything romantic was just not going to happen. She wasn't interested. And according to Sandy, Humphrey began acting like she was his girlfriend, even though she'd said those things. He even told people that they were having sex when they weren't. But Sandy did end up having sex with him, but she didn't consider it consensual. The few times she'd had sex with him, he made her feel threatened into it. So she either gave in or he would become violent. And that's how she felt. So he forced himself on her, and she went along simply because it was easier than risking the physical retaliation. And that makes me sad because I think there's a self-esteem issue there as well, to allow this to happen to her.
Yeah, it's dismaying.
It is.
So Sandy and Humphrey hung out after work a lot. Humphrey was intimidating. He's well over 6 feet and weighed over 200 pounds, 225 or so. Sandy was in pretty good shape also, but she is small, so she's probably a foot shorter and 100 pounds lighter than Humphrey.
Yeah, she was pretty tiny.
So one night, shortly after they had started working together at the same nightclub, Humphrey asked Sandy for a ride home. They had just finished a shift, and it was late. Sandy agreed, "I'll take you home." So they chatted on the way to Humphrey's apartment, and he was working his magic on her. He told her he'd played on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers football team. He also told her that he had won the Heisman Trophy. That's the top college football player. So
Yeah. All a story.
Right. He never won the Heisman. He never played professional football. He never played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
No, he actually had a pretty good criminal record in his past. But he did have this weightlifter's physique, which made these stories seem possible if he didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy'd worked as a personal trainer before, and she knew that it took a lot of effort to look like him. But he'd never played on the NFL team or won any trophies. In fact, in and out of prison most of his life, and most alarmingly, for perpetrating violence against women. So he'd also said
but
he was...
But she didn't know that.
No, she didn't know anything about that. About his prison record. So she would figure that out eventually, or at least get some idea about it. But no, as far as she knew, he was an ex-football player.
Yeah.
Who went to college. Also, he told her that he was a model. But he had never been a model either. But these lines had worked for him with women quite a few times. And he was doing the same thing with Sandy. Actually, he was a complete phony and a narcissist. Just lying to get her interested in him. He knew that he would never get women by admitting who he really was, this 30-something-year-old guy who was just moving from job to job with no real career or plan for the future and a horrible history with women.
Yeah, he's just drifting along, taking what he can get.
Taking people down with him, yeah.
So they get to his place. He invited Sandy into his apartment, and they talked. Nothing physical happened, and they were friends. Sandy lived only about a half mile from his apartment at this time, so she was pretty cool with picking him up for work whenever he needed a ride. Sandy had gotten Humphrey the job, so she did feel a little bit responsible for him, making sure he got to work on time, because she didn't want to have him make her look bad.
Yeah, it would reflect poorly on her, because she'd said that they should hire him.
She recommended him.
Yep.
For a few months, the friendship seemed pretty fine. Humphrey didn't hit on her. And Sandy believed that she was beginning to see the relationship would be nothing more than a friendship. Now, as far as she knew, Humphrey was accepting that also. She didn't know him as well as she thought she did, and she didn't have any way of knowing that he was a man who didn't accept no as an answer from women when he decided he wanted to have sex with her.
So that's a lousy trait in a person.
It certainly is.
On New Year's Eve 2001, things changed and they got worse. Sandy picked Humphrey up at his apartment and drove him to work with her, and that was a really busy night, of course, New Year's Eve. Sandy offered to drive him home after, and they agreed they'd meet up at the end of the night. Pretty big place, so they weren't really in the same location all the time. After closing, Sandy said later, she still had people that needed to close out their tabs at the bar, so when she finally finished, the bar was deserted. She walked downstairs, where Humphrey had been working as a bouncer all night, and she was looking for him, but she couldn't find him. So she's tired, it's late, she finally assumed he must have left. Maybe he got a ride home with someone else. So throughout the time Humphrey had worked at the bar, Sandy had seen many of his old friends from Tampa and Miami coming in. So she thought, well, he's probably run into some old friends and gone off with them. So she left. She was exhausted. A long night on her feet, so she just wanted to go home and really didn't think anything about it.
Not at all. So she gets home, it's like 4 in the morning. She fell asleep, boom. And 2 hours later, she woke up. Her cell phone is vibrating on her nightstand. She was tired, so she decided that whoever it was on the phone could wait. Then the next morning, while she's drinking her coffee, she checked her voicemails. And she found 3 very explicit, very threatening phone calls, all from Tracy Humphrey. And he sounded like he had gone nuts. He was upset, first of all, because Sandy had left him at the bar without a ride home.
So that's the kind of behavior you're going to expect from someone who's narcissistic, for sure.
Right.
It's all about him.
So, and that was his first very irrational complaint.
Yeah.
And by the third message, he's yelling at her for not wanting to have a romantic relationship with him. And he threatened to kill her.
Yeah, how dare she, right?
You'll probably need to start dating a plastic surgeon, he told her, because by the time I'm finished with your face, you're going to need one. What a sweetheart.
So this is just a friend of his that he's treating like this because she left the establishment. So it's just super weird, way off the handle, wouldn't you say?
Very much so. And that's when maybe you call the police.
Yes, right. So Sandy really didn't look out for herself as much as she could have. But I say that at the same time, not blaming her for any of this, because none of this was her fault.
That's true.
But Humphrey had revealed himself as this violent, possibly psychotic person. Sandy was terrified, as most people would be. She was afraid of what would happen the next time she saw this guy. And she had to, because she had to go to work. She was really freaked out after listening to his messages, which showed this really dark side of Humphrey that she hadn't known about. He obviously had some deep anger issues which had come out that morning.
Jeez, yes.
Yeah. So she knew that she'd made the right decision not dating him. That was one thing that was a relief. Because over the past 10 years or so of her life, she'd chosen the wrong guys. And now she was at a place where she was trying to make positive changes and make better choices. So Humphrey was definitely the wrong man for her, and she knew that. But her rejection of him was blowing up in her face as well. She'd falsely believed that Humphrey was accepting that they were just work pals. It had seemed that way for months. He seemed like a pretty good friend, and she had actually felt like she could talk to him, and then now this.
Yeah, because for several weeks he had treated her pretty nicely. But now she was seeing, or hearing, a different side of him. So she called a friend and talked to her about what had happened. And then another friend came over that day and recorded the messages from Sandy's voicemail. And she told Sandy to call the police because he had made direct threats on her life.
Yes, absolutely.
Like things happened, time passed. They still worked at the same club, but they rarely saw each other because he worked downstairs and she worked upstairs. So it was pretty easy to stay away from him. And Sandy eventually decided that calling the police wasn't necessary because he'd been acting okay and the threat had faded away.
And I could see how you might feel that way. Like maybe he just got drunk and had a bad night.
Oh, boy. I don't know.
I know. It's very generous of her. A little too generous.
Yeah, and plus she's also worried that if she did call the police, that could set him off again.
Well, and that's valid. It probably would.
Yes.
But what are you going to do? You really need to report this stuff.
Yeah, you do. But I guess, like you said, things had gone okay for a while.
Yeah.
And then he had this blow up. And then things seemed to calm down again. So maybe it was an aberration and she figured, okay, I don't need to notify the police.
Right. I mean, whatever this reason was why he went nuts on her, she was definitely willing to forgive and forget and move on.
But without him.
Yes. She didn't want him to be a part of her life. I just think that he kept pressuring her to be in her life. And I don't know, was she not tough enough with him? Who knows? I mean, he was a scary guy.
Yeah.
But she didn't get the help she probably should have gotten.
Well, it might have been a good idea to quit that job and take another job, not work with him in the same environment.
Well, in hindsight, yeah, and move away would even be a good idea.
Yeah, but...
Yeah. But she didn't know that.
No. Then a couple weeks later, Sandy was going to Las Vegas for a vacation, and she was super excited. So Humphrey had heard she was going to be away for a week, and he approached her at work to talk. He seemed to be apologetic. And he admitted that he had snapped. He asked to come over to her place that night to say goodbye. He told her he had a birthday gift he wanted to give her before she left.
Now, see, she probably should have said no to that.
I don't want to say shoulds and
I know.
All that stuff, but
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, finger-pointing here, but it's just so frustrating. But you can see the manipulation taking place. He says, well, I have a gift for you I want to give you, so... Saying you can't come over, it's hard to be so bitchy.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a nasty woman.
It does.
But
it doesn't sound like you're open to being friendly or, you know, at least on good terms.
Yeah. Well, he's probably a master at this manipulation stuff.
Yes, he was good at it. And Sandy was, I'm sure, hesitant to have him come to her home. But she agreed. She saw this as a gesture of forgiveness. So Humphrey stopped by later that night, but all he really had was a birthday card, so the gift thing, I think, was really just bullshit manipulation tactics.
Yes.
He stood in the doorway because Sandy wasn't comfortable letting him into her apartment, so good for her on that. It was going to take her some time to trust him again, she said. So he gave her the birthday card, and then he asked her to wait and read it on the plane on her way to Vegas. So she said she would, and then he said, well, when you get back from your trip, I'd like to talk, and she agreed to that as well. But, you know, part of that was she just wanted him to leave, and she just would say almost anything if it would just move things along and get him away from her door.
That gets him out of there.
Exactly. And I can certainly relate to that. We've all had to do that.
So Sandy had a good time off in Vegas. She came to Florida, or returned to Florida, 5 days after she left. And right away, Humphrey contacted her, and he said he wanted to meet, and he also wanted to explain his actions. So Sandy said, okay, I will meet with you. I'm going to meet you at a restaurant, kind of a neutral place, and that's where one of her girlfriends worked. So they went to the restaurant, as Sandy later explained, but there was another episode. So the details weren't exactly shared, but afterwards Humphrey returned to the restaurant and got in an altercation with Sandy's girlfriend and her boyfriend. So the boyfriend is at the restaurant, just visiting his girlfriend who worked there. There's Humphrey yelling at them because they didn't want Sandy to have contact with him. That must have been some little tiff. So
he was pretty crazy.
He did something that got Sandy going. He left.
Yes, right. It's just crazy. And, of course, the girlfriend didn't want Sandy to have anything to do with him. But just the fact that she wanted to do it in a neutral place where she knew someone tells you that she was afraid of him.
Yeah.
More afraid maybe than she was letting on to other people at that point. So the girlfriend and her boyfriend were upset that Sandy was meeting with him at all, even in a public place. Humphrey got pissed off about that and told them to mind their own business. The girlfriend called Sandy from the restaurant to tell her that Humphrey had returned and made a scene, and that he'd had to be escorted out. They had to call the police. So she was hoping that this was the end of it, but of course it wasn't.
Now, a few days later, Humphrey turned up at Sandy's apartment and buzzed her from the front gate. Sandy lived in this community where he had to be buzzed in by someone who lived there in order to get into the parking lot. So Humphrey couldn't get into the property unless Sandy had permitted him to. Now, he was actually waiting for people who lived there to come home so he could sneak in behind them. But it was late, close to 1 a.m., so nobody's coming in. Sandy buzzed him in herself.
Yeah, and why did she do that? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
It's the frustrating thing.
It is the frustrating part. Sandy felt that she'd given him enough chances already, but then she agreed to see him outside of her door again. She decided she'd give him a few minutes there on the steps, but she knew that he really had these serious anger issues. She wanted him out of her life. She'd been with many abusive men, and she wanted to move past that kind of thing. Humphrey tried to get her to let him into the apartment, but she refused, and he did seem to give up that night without getting too angry. So she might have taken that as a sign as well. He's not really as dangerous as he sounds.
Possibly. Sandy drove Humphrey to work maybe a half dozen times after those incidents, and she never said why. Probably she wanted to help him, and she probably felt sorry for him.
Well, anyone that I saw interviews with that knew her said she was just like the nicest, kindest person you can imagine.
Didn't want to be mean to anybody.
Exactly.
Sandy wasn't completely naive. She did feel like Humphrey was kind of a ticking time bomb. But she didn't know how bad it could get. He was on steroids, which she didn't know, and that only enhanced his rage. One of his ex-girlfriends later told police that he would be completely normal for days or even weeks, but then he would inevitably lose his temper, swearing, breaking things, and even getting physically abusive.
Yeah, so one bad thing that happened that February was that Sandy was transferred to work downstairs alongside Humphrey. And here's where she's too nice again. She should have told her boss, "I can't do that," and explained, but she didn't. So now she couldn't really avoid him nearly as much as she had been. So he gradually worked back, trying to get on her good side, using his skills as a con man to try and earn back her trust, which he in no way deserved.
No.
So one day Humphrey asked Sandy if she would take him to church with her, and she agreed, and they went to Mass together. Afterwards, he asked her to drive him to the gym to work out. So Sandy worked out with him, and she had dinner with him, but just as a friend. It wasn't romantic at all, at least not to Sandy, but I'm sure to Humphrey it was.
Well, sure. The more time he can spend with her, the more he's going to think, in his mind, that she really likes him. So after a couple of weeks of friendship, Humphrey began again to pressure Sandy into having sex with him. He said they were getting closer, and he felt like the only thing missing was the sex. He begged her. He pleaded with her. He pushed her. He told her that it had been years since he'd slept with a woman. He said, "You're the chosen one, and I'm going to have sex with you one way or another." Well, that's a great thing. Sandy hoped he was joking, and she really didn't understand how their friendship would give him the idea to hit on her again. So when she declined his kind offer of sex, he predictably became angry, and he called her a prick tease. Well, yeah, that's what guys would do. They're not getting any.
Yeah, shitty guys.
So, and then Sandy started crying. Humphrey sensed that she was vulnerable. So he insulted her, he threatened her.
Well, yeah, he took that opportunity right there to just abuse her. I think he sensed that she was a person who had been abused before and could be manipulated in that way. Because why in the world would she put up with any of this? Why would she hope he was joking when he said that? She was a smart woman. Being a waitress and a bartender, she must have had to deal with all kinds of guys hitting on her.
Must have.
Yeah, so he must have been really good at this. He told her that she was playing games with him, using him for friendship and dinners, but then holding out on him sexually, trying to make her feel guilty. Horrible. And Sandy was just an emotional wreck. She, not having the highest self-esteem, believed some of these insults. And believe it or not, she gave in and allowed him to have sex with her, even though she didn't want to do it. So isn't that sad?
I told you, this whole thing is sad.
Yes. So, essentially, that's a rape. Because he had to know in the beginning, she said no, and he wore her down.
Not essentially. I mean, if it's not consensual, it is rape.
Exactly. You're right. That is rape.
So, and Sandy felt at the time that she had no choice, and she was afraid to say no to him. So after that night, she tried to back away from him, but she still continued to be way too kind for her own good, and she ended up driving Humphrey to work the next few times they were both scheduled to work. She seemed to be afraid to cut him off all at once. And certainly, I mean, she could remember his voice messages full of anger and threats. Then he began leaving her messages again. Humphrey left an additional 20-something threats on her phone, so Sandy's feeling trapped. Humphrey also knew that Sandy had a daughter, and she believed he was capable of anything. In order to avoid whatever horrors he had planned for her, she tried to let him down slowly and carefully. But what she didn't realize was that nothing that she's going to do could stop him from coming after her.
No, it doesn't matter how slowly or carefully she tries to let him down. He wants what he wants. He does not have any empathy or consideration for women, and he's going to do what he wants. So, February 22nd of 2002, Humphrey showed up at Sandy's apartment. He was uninvited. She'd loaned him some money, and he buzzed her to tell her that he had the money to pay her back. So that's why she buzzed him in. So he said if she just let him in, he'd give her the cash and he'd leave right away. So she went ahead and did that. But after buzzing him in, she did let him into her apartment. She was getting ready for work. So Humphrey asked her for a ride and she didn't really want to, but she agreed to do that. He had just finished exercising at the gym, he said, but he had his work clothes with him. So Sandy allowed him to change in her bathroom. So as Humphrey was in there changing, Sandy thought about how she was going to break up with him and just get him out of her life. So she thought on the drive, that would be a good time to talk to him about it and tell him this whole thing's over. But remember, she's terrified of this man. Someone who frightens you can't be your friend, and she didn't want it to continue. So that night on the way home from work, Sandy tried to tell him as kindly as she could. She didn't want anything to do with him anymore. But that ride home was just horrible. They got into an argument, and she drove them to her apartment building because he'd left his car parked in her lot there. But when she went in to walk to her apartment, he followed her inside without her consent. So Sandy still thought, well, he's just going to yell at me and leave. But this time he went totally out of control. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Sandy just wanted him to leave so she could get some sleep. But he started yelling and screaming at her and like throwing his fists in the air like a roid rage. So at this point, Sandy decided she'd be direct. I just cannot handle your aggressive behavior anymore, she told him. Humphrey said something about her being his girlfriend, and she didn't like that at all. She told him, I don't ever want to be your girlfriend. So this did not go well.
Jill, what are you burning out here? Bodies?
Well, no. I'm throwing in all of our earbuds and headphones with a little bit of lighter fluid as my protest against podcast ads in my favorite shows. I'm just getting into a story or I'm dozing off and it's interrupted with commercials. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Nice movie reference. Anyway, let's just simmer down here. You do know that our True Crime Brewery listeners have the option to subscribe to our premium show for ad-free episodes and bonus episodes, right? It costs as little as $4 per month, and these contributions help support the cost of producing TCB.
Well, of course. I love and appreciate our subscribers. You know, I worked for weeks with our IT girl to set that up, and all because I have a deeply held belief that our listeners shouldn't have to hear ads.
That's well said. Now, let me ask you this. How are we going to record this week's episode without our headphones?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, you stay here. I'll go get the hose.
Okay, hurry.
Now, so Humphrey paced around her apartment. Sandy's telling him to leave. He's ignoring her. She's asking him repeatedly, and he refused repeatedly. So they ended up arguing until almost 9 in the morning. Humphrey then told her He wanted sex, and Sandy didn't want that at all. But Humphrey convinced her sex is going to happen whether she consented or not. So she's terrified. She's exhausted. She was felt like she was threatened, alone, and afraid. And she was afraid if she fought him, he could end up killing her. Like we said, he was a good deal bigger than she was.
Yes.
So in some kind of survival mode, she allowed him to have sex with her, to rape her. Afterwards, she felt disgusted. She had agreed to the sex just for her own survival.
Sure, yeah.
They both fell asleep afterwards, and Sandy woke up around 1:30 in the afternoon.
So this was just the beginning of a long nightmare for her.
This is horrible.
When she woke up, Humphrey was standing over her bed, kicking it to force her to wake up. And he had this crazy look on his face that she hadn't seen before, and he was screaming at her, "I fucking hate you, I fucking hate you." It was just way off the charts. Then he jumped up on the bed and straddled her with his knees around her head and his penis hanging over her face. His face was red, almost purple, and he was poking his erection in her face. Sandy couldn't move at all, and she was afraid to scream because she felt like he was really going to kill her. But he yelled at her repeatedly, "This is my motherfucking day, and you're going to show me respect." Sandy was in tears and just terrified. "You know what?" he said. "You're going to sign your fucking car over to me. Yes, your car. I've spent approximately $250 on you going out to dinner and stuff, and I don't pay anybody's bills. I want some money out of you, you bitch." So he was really off the rails.
He's lost it.
Yes.
So Sandy knew that his rage had reached a new level, something she'd never seen before. He's screaming words that she couldn't understand while he's holding down her head between his knees. And he repeated that she was going to sign over her car and fill out a false insurance claim that had been stolen from the apartment lot. So Sandy refused, and he hit her in the face with his closed fist. Then he punched her again, and one of her eyes started bleeding. So at this point, she says, "Okay, I'll sign over the car to you," thinking, "I'll do anything to get you out of this apartment."
Oh, absolutely.
So she's pretty devastated, but this horrible nightmare wasn't over.
No, no. He had spent a lot of time and energy making Sandy believe he was sorry for what he'd done to her in the past, and I think it was just so he could get in and do something like this. She'd wanted to think that he was just a guy looking for a break, but now she totally regretted giving him so many chances. She was now held captive in her own home by this enraged, unpredictable, scary guy. Humphrey accused Sandy of not treating him with respect. He knew what he was doing, and he even told her several times that he was committing a crime. He knew that Sandy wanted him out of her apartment, and he knew that he was hurting her. He was throwing her around like a rag doll. Then he grabbed Sandy by the arms and dragged her out of the bed and told her it was time for her to write out the statement about the car. And if she refused, he was going to force her to whatever he had to do. So that was a pretty big threat.
Yeah, so Sandy tried to scramble away, but fell to the floor while she was moving. Humphrey was completely enraged, so he punched her again. And he told Sandy that while she was sleeping, he had called a friend and had given this friend all of Sandy's personal information, including her daughter's phone number. Sandy didn't care about her financial information or the car, but she was terrified of anyone hurting her daughter. Humphrey threatened her again, telling her that if she told anyone what he had done to her, he knew men who would gang rape her until she would be begging him to kill her to put her out of her misery. Sweetheart.
Yeah, that's not a subtle statement.
So he kept beating her. He raped her again. She's screaming. No one can hear her. Then when he's finished, he sat down on the floor next to the bed. And this is while Sandy's lying in the bed, crying in the fetal position. She didn't know what to do. And she was worried that she was going to die, that Humphrey was going to kill her.
I think that's a totally reasonable fear at this point.
Yeah, he's totally lost it.
Yes. I mean, I think even he probably didn't know what he was going to do next because he'd just been acting out of rage.
Yeah, he probably didn't.
It was near 8:30 p.m. when Sandy said that she had to use the phone and call work. There was no way she could go in, even if Humphrey had allowed her to leave. And also, he was scheduled to be at work, too. So walking out of the room, he said something about him calling in to work for the both of them, and then he left the room. He called the bar and told them that he and Sandy had been in a car accident, so that was his cover story. When he returned, he was looking at Sandy's bruised and bloody face, and that's when he made the predictable turn from being enraged to being remorseful. At least saying he was remorseful.
Yeah. I'm so sorry, baby. I'll never do it again. Please believe me.
Exactly.
Yeah, God.
He even got her a washcloth and an ice pack and laid by her, and he was crying and apologizing. He was saying he wanted to kill himself. And all this time, she's beaten to a pulp. Her eyes are so swollen she can hardly see. All she could do to listen to him and just pray that he would eventually leave. But he stayed, and late Saturday afternoon, after an entire night and morning of watching her rapist cry and apologize to her, Sandy told him that she had to work that night. She needed her job, and she just couldn't afford to get fired or lose her job. He told her the only way she could go to work was if she promised to go along with his car accident story. That was his plan to explain what he had done to Sandy's face and make it look like, of course, he was not responsible. But one problem was that he had no visible injuries himself.
Yeah, it was an accident with only one side of the car involved, right?
Yeah. But as Sandy was trying to clean up her injuries, Humphrey went into the bathroom. And what he did is he took one of Sandy's razors and taped it to a toothbrush and made like a prison shank, pretty much. He said he was going to cut his jugular vein with the shank and bleed to death right in front of her. So he said he could never go back to prison, so he had no choice but to end his life at that point. Sandy at this point wasn't going to try and convince him not to, but she was terrified to look at him through her swollen, aching eyes. Then she heard him ask her if she forgave him. When she finally looked at him, he'd cut his throat, and there was an incision about 3 inches long, but he hadn't cut his jugular. It still looked like a lot of blood to Sandy, but it wasn't that serious of an injury. Sandy ended up helping him clean up and bandaged his neck, so she's taking care of him now.
Yeah.
And she promised to go along with the car accident story, and they drove to work together. That's just crazy. Outrageous.
Yeah, so they did make it into work. It was close to 9 o'clock. Everyone was crowding around. Everyone that worked there was crowding around Humphrey, and he told his story. It really upset Sandy to hear their co-workers commiserating with Humphrey, you know, how sorry they were for them. And they got this crowd of people around him, this guy who's a rapist, physically beaten her. And then he looked up at her and he winked. God, I would have taken out a knife. And
yeah, what an awful, awful human.
Unfortunately, Humphrey wasn't scheduled to work downstairs that night, so he was free to walk around the bar. And this would keep him upstairs near her, so he could watch anything that Sandy was doing. And he let her know that he could pull her out of the bar and kill her at any moment.
So I guess he's not sorry anymore. He went past that.
We're back to enraged again.
Okay.
So when the work shift ended, Humphrey drove them both back to Sandy's place. Sandy hadn't said anything to anyone, and she hadn't called the police. So at 6 a.m., they get back to her apartment. Sandy told Humphrey that she needed to go to the airport for a trip to Pittsburgh because she's supposed to meet her mother there. The trip had been planned for a long time, and Sandy was going to help her mother and while she was there visit with some old friends. And she told Humphrey if she didn't show up, they'd all wonder what was going on. So Humphrey thought about this, and then he eventually let her go after he reminded her of his threats of what would happen if she told anyone.
Yeah, but now she did try and stand up for herself at this point. She didn't go to Pittsburgh. She went to see her good friend, Amber. Amber was engaged to an attorney, and they offered to help Sandy figure out what to do. They were horrified by this. They made a plan for Sandy to stay at Amber's overnight, then they'd drive back to Tampa and talk to the police. But the next morning, Humphrey started calling Sandy on her cell phone and leaving her voice messages. All of them were clearly aimed at intimidating her. There was a real threatening underlying chill in each call. Humphrey was using his manipulation skills to frighten her. It was definitely working. And he reminded her that he knew where everyone in her family lived, and he knew where to find her daughter. He said, just stick to the car accident story. Don't do anything stupid. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement took photos of Sandy's injuries, and they also dusted her apartment for fingerprints. Agents interviewed Sandy, and she held nothing back from her story. As agents interviewed her, her phone kept ringing. So Sandy walked over, looked at the caller ID, and said to one of the agents, see, that's him calling now. Humphrey called her 13 times, just while the agents were in her apartment. And as the interview took place, Humphrey got into an altercation with their boss, and he got fired.
Huh. So Tracy Humphrey is arrested and charged with assault. Now, he had this past record, so he's looking a good 10 years in prison. And he was determined never to go back to prison. Now, he gets out on bail?
Yep, he was out on bail.
How does he do that?
Well, they let him out. He wasn't a flight risk.
But he had done what he did to her.
I know.
And threatened he was going to kill her.
Oh, I know. It's horrible.
Okay.
And there should be more charges, I think, too. But that's what happened. They let him out. And he went and got a job working in a gym in the town of Brandon, Florida. It was at this gym where he met 19-year-old Ashley Laney. And things got more complex.
Yeah, because at around the same time, Sandy met a guy named Tony Ponacal. He was everything that Humphrey was not. He was kind, he was stable, and boring. But boring in the best way possible. So they started dating. They moved into a townhouse together in February of 2003. And before that, they had lived together in Tampa, close to where Sandy took a bartending job at the Green Iguana. Her court date to testify against Humphrey was coming up on August 4th, 2003.
So Ashley Laney, she was just 19 years old in September of 2002 when she first walked into the athletic club in Brandon, where Tracy Humphrey was working as a trainer. She'd come from a broken home, and her mom, at least according to Ashley, drank to excess. Her mother had also introduced her to marijuana, she would say. Her father was in prison for sexual assault when she was born, so she had no relationship with him. But still, she did well all through school. And a lot of this was due to the support of her grandmother. But then in her senior year, when her grandmother died, she lost the most positive role model in her life. She felt pretty abandoned. But still, she managed to graduate with honors. But then she ended up dropping out during her first year in college. So when she met Humphrey, Ashley was just a beautiful girl. She joined the Brandon Athletic Club to give herself a fresh start in life and to get healthy and fit. She wanted to meet new people, too, and make some friends. Now, this gym was really close to her mom's house where she was still living, and she had a job at Planet Smoothie, which was just across the street, so she could finish her shift and just run over and work out most days. Sounded like a good idea for her. Living with her mom and her mom's new boyfriend wasn't working out for her. She wasn't happy with that. And it wasn't the best situation because it was a tiny house, so she had to sleep on the couch. So Ashley went in. She bought two memberships at the gym. One was for her and one was for her girlfriend. And it wasn't long after she joined the gym when she was introduced to Tracy Humphrey as a personal trainer. Now, he was fit and muscular, really different from boys she had dated in the past. She was immediately infatuated with him. He was tall and burly, like we said, over 6 feet tall, and he told Ashley that he lived in Brandon near the gym. He said he liked the warmth of Florida, the pretty women with the golden tans, and all the perks that came to him from being a personal trainer. But you know, Humphrey's physique didn't come strictly from working out and eating well. This guy was super jacked up on steroids. The clues you could probably notice would be the pockmarked face, the back acne, and more than anything, these angry, rageful outbursts he was known for. But of course, Ashley didn't experience this rage right away, and he told her all the same lies he'd told other women. But over the next months, she would become familiar with his temper and his rages.
Yeah, she was 19, young, inexperienced. So Ashley was easily taken in by Humphrey. He told her the same thing he had told other women. College football, Heisman winner, pro football, blah, blah, blah. But he didn't talk about his time in prison.
No, he conveniently left that out.
Yeah. And the reality was that Humphrey had been in and out of prison for the past 15 years. So just 2 weeks after she joined the gym, Humphrey hit on Ashley. He offered to be her personal trainer, and this was something he did with any woman he found attractive. He told Ashley he was 29, even though he was well into his 30s. He had no problem dating such a young woman. Why not? They're much more easy to control and manipulate.
And he knew that.
Of course.
I'm sure, yeah. She was a beautiful girl, too. But so was Sandy. She was a beautiful woman. But anyway, they went out to the movies together on their first date, and they saw Road to Perdition. That's a Tom Hanks movie. Pretty good one. As they walked up to the box office counter, Ashley caught Humphrey staring at her backside, and he said to her some line like, "I'm just looking for the place on your back where I'm going to get my name tattooed." Just a real smooth operator.
That's a smooth line, isn't
it? Yeah. But when the movie ended, they went back to Humphrey's car, and he drove them to the gym, where Ashley had left her VW Beetle. She'd left her car at the gym because she didn't want Humphrey to know where she lived. At this point, she was dating another younger guy, and she didn't want these two to learn about each other.
Good idea.
Yep. But there were more important reasons why she wouldn't want him to know where she lived. But of course, she didn't know that.
She did not.
No.
So Humphrey joked with Ashley about her young age, and he manipulated her into agreeing to go to his apartment with him. She did. And according to Ashley, they did some sexual things, but they didn't have intercourse. So their next date, to another movie, ended up with Ashley at his apartment having intercourse with him. Then by early October 2002, they were not only dating, they were inseparable. Now, Humphrey seemed nice, but he was often aggressive. And as off-putting as that was, he could be a loving, gentle person. Ashley didn't know that Humphrey was an ex-con and a liar who had spent most of his adult life manipulating people for his own benefit.
In early 2003, Ashley quit her job at the smoothie place, and she began working at the gym alongside Humphrey. In late March 2003, Ashley moved into an apartment with Humphrey and a friend of his, and this was a small place in Brandon. They were in love by then and already talking about getting married. At least Ashley felt like she was in love with him. He made her feel special. But her friends thought that Humphrey was a bad influence. In April, Humphrey told Ashley that he was facing serious prison time for what he called a false accusation of assault by an ex. And of course, he'd waited until he had her wrapped up in this relationship before he mentioned this.
Mm-hmm.
His talk about Sandy painted her in the worst possible light, prompting Ashley to resent and eventually kind of hate Sandy. He told Ashley that Sandy had made up the charges and that he would do anything to avoid prison, and they even discussed maybe they should run away or both commit suicide.
So on July 4th, 2003, Tracy Humphrey married Ashley. They got married in the gym where they worked. They had no rings. They had no guests. All they had was a marriage license. They had each other's names tattooed on their backs. Oh, that's so sweet. No honeymoon was planned, but Sandy Razzo ended up getting murdered.
Yes, that was July 5th, and Ashley sat inside a car watching the Green Iguana parking lot. She had her cell phone, and she was talking to Tracy Humphrey on it. She told him that Sandy was there as she focused on her target. This was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon when Ashley showed up at Sandy's workplace. Sandy had pulled into her regular space at the Green Iguana Bar and Grill in Rocky Point. She got out and she locked her car. Then she walked into the bar for her bartending shift. Rocky Point's a small island just west of Tampa Airport, and it's a really popular area with a lot of nice hotels and restaurants. So what Humphrey said to Ashley over the cell phone was, "Go get ready now." So she got off the phone with him and got into the back seat and put on a pair of baggy pants, a large sweatshirt, and a baseball hat. She also painted on blackface as part of her plan to make herself look like a black man.
That's just nuts.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
At Humphrey's odd request, Ashley got out of the car and took a short walk around the parking lot to see if anyone would notice her. So that seemed really stupid. You're just getting more exposure. But it had looked like no one was interested in this nervous-looking person wearing what looked like this crazy Halloween costume in the middle of the summer. But back inside the car, Ashley waited for Sandy to come out of the bar. And as soon as she came out of the building after her shift, Ashley was supposed to go up to Sandy and shoot her. Just keep shooting her until the magazine of bullets was empty. Ashley and Humphrey had gone over this part of this murder plan many times. They'd rehearsed it and they'd talked about it. And they had made one previous attempt, which failed when the shotgun went off too soon. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, but this time, Ashley had a semi-automatic 22mm Ruger pistol. Humphrey had taught her how to shoot the weapon, but he's still worried about her carrying it off. Writing out her plan and noting where the exits from the bar were located, Ashley knew that it was impossible to murder Sandy in the parking lot. It got dark as Ashley waited. She came up with her own variation of the plan, thought about it, and then she nodded off and fell asleep in her car.
So how weird is that? I don't understand. This is, I think she was 20 at this point, and she's never done anything really illegal that we know of, and she's there waiting to kill someone, and she can nod off to sleep. There's just really a lot of psychology with Ashley that interests me. We'll get into a little bit of that, I hope. But anyway, she dozed off, and it was 10:30 p.m. with a full moon when Sandy Razzo brought her cash drawer to her boss, and she was in a great mood that night. Business had been steady, but everything had been smooth, and as she prepared to punch out, there was still a big holiday weekend crowd there. If she was anxious or thought she was being stalked, nobody saw any signs of that. She looked like she was happy and glowing with her bronze skin and this big white smile she had as she headed out after work. But, you know, Sandy was private and not one to share her problems with her coworkers. And now she was living with a man who treated her well and took care of her. But she wasn't feeling really smitten or in love with this guy. She may have been settling, but this was one of the best men she'd ever known. She had been married before, but that hadn't worked out, and now she was very cautious about who she was letting into her life, especially since this horror movie-like experience that she'd had with Tracy Humphrey.
Yeah, now usually Sandy liked to drive her BMW with the top down, but on this last night of her life, she drove with it up. Maybe she was tired. Sandy drove toward the Pinellas Park townhome she shared with her boyfriend, Tony. On her passenger seat, she had the empty CD case for one of her favorite Madonna CDs. Madonna was one of Sandy's favorites, and she often sang along on her 30-minute ride home. So life wasn't perfect for Sandy, but it was looking up. She'd been under a lot of stress with the court case against Humphrey coming up in a month.
Can you imagine? I'd be terrified.
I know.
They should have kept that guy in prison or jail.
I'm not sure how he got out.
But I know.
Sandy was smart. And she'd been alive long enough to know that things would get better. It had only been about a year since she'd been beaten, raped, and held captive in her own home. So if you consider everything, she's ended up being a strong and positive person.
I think she did a lot better than I would. Outside of the townhome that she shared with Tony, Sandy didn't see anyone, but Ashley was following her. Ashley had actually been there many times before. She'd been stalking Sandy and casing out the place. Ashley had called Humphrey as she was driving to the townhome, and he yelled at her, "Get out at a stoplight and just shoot her." Ashley was now familiar with the hate and rage in his voice. She knew he'd be angry with her if she didn't follow through with the murder. She also believed that Sandy could end her relationship with Humphrey when she testified against him in 1 month because he'd go to prison. As Sandy pulled her car into the garage, Ashley pulled in front of a neighbor's townhouse and turned off the headlights of her car. So at this point, Sandy was in her garage, and she put her car into park. There was less than a minute left before Sandy would get out and walk into her home through the inside garage door. But Ashley pulled up and parked at the end of Sandy's driveway. Then she jumped out with the gun and ran into the garage.
And so Sandy's picking up her purse and clothes in the car when she probably saw Ashley in her costume. Ashley hit the window of the car, the driver's side window, trying to shatter it, but it didn't work. So Ashley shot at the window to break it, and then she shot several more times at Sandy. Sandy reacted to this by kicking and screaming. However, one bullet did hit her foot and went through it, striking her face. Ashley kept firing until the gun was empty. That was 8 rounds. And while she's shooting, she's staring right at Sandy's face. Sandy tried to fight for her life, but it proved to be impossible because one bullet hit her right between the eyes. Boom, she's dead.
Well, she looked dead, but she was still technically holding on. Her face and torso were splattered with blood, and it was soaking onto her clothing. Ashley ran away down the driveway and drove off immediately. And once she got to the main road, she called Humphrey and told him that the deed was done. "It's over," she said, "and I want pizza." Ashley had completed her task, and she expected pizza as a reward. "I want double cheese and chicken and tomatoes," she told Humphrey. But he told her double cheese was too fattening. Besides, he'd already ordered pizza for their late-night dinner.
She's able to nap before she kills the woman. And then afterwards, "I want a pizza." Jeez.
I know. So was she brainwashed, or was she just as sociopathic as he was?
Yes.
Both?
Maybe both, but she was nuts like he was.
Yeah, I almost think you'd have to be, but...
Yeah.
I mean, he was certainly heavily influencing her, which you can see happening. She was only 20. But just this casual-like behavior makes me think either her mind was altered by some kind of brainwashing or drugs or something, or she was almost as bad as he was, just as bad as he was.
Exactly. Sandy's live-in boyfriend, he'd fallen asleep about 9 o'clock. He woke up from his sleep when he heard loud popping noises. And it sounded like someone was setting off some fireworks out front. And it wasn't too concerning to him because it's the 4th of July weekend. Everyone in Florida was setting off fireworks. So he ran downstairs in his boxers and looked through the front door peephole. Didn't see anything or anyone. He walked through the kitchen toward the garage door, thinking maybe something had exploded, like a paint can or some aerosol cans, or maybe even gasoline. And when he was walking through the kitchen, he looked at the microwave and he saw that it was 10 after 11. The first thing he saw after opening the garage door was Sandy's car. So she's home. But the garage door was still open.
Yeah, the big door to the outside.
Yeah, and the light from the overhead garage door opener was still on. It shut itself off automatically, so Tony knew that Sandy had just gotten in, you know, within a minute or so.
Yeah, it all happened really fast.
He couldn't see Sandy anywhere, and as he walked around the driver's side of the car, he saw thousands of bits of broken glass on the cement floor. He heard a faint voice and noticed that the driver's side window was broken out. Then with a couple more steps, he peeked in the window and was able to see Sandy.
Yeah, Sandy was hunched over the console between the driver and passenger seats. Her legs were still underneath the steering wheel, but from the chest up, she was lying down on the passenger seat, with her head abnormally slumped over the edge. So Tony pulled Sandy up and then ran to the other side of the car, screaming out her name as he opened the door. But then he saw all the blood, way too much blood. Sandy's face was covered with it, and there was splattered blood all over the inside of that car. Sandy didn't seem to be breathing, so Tony picked up her cell phone and immediately called 911. Tony sounded out of breath on the call, but he also had kind of this stoic, calm voice, which if you knew him, you'd know that was just his way, but it did cause some suspicion in the beginning.
Oh, sure.
He's the boyfriend. But he gave the operator the address and explained what had happened the best he could, and as the operator sent out paramedics and police, he was holding Sandy up and trying to help her. After Tony was told that Sandy'd been shot after everyone arrived, he told investigators that he knew who was responsible for killing her. There was no doubt in his mind that Tracy Humphrey was responsible. In fact, Sandy had told him once, "If I'm ever killed, this is the person responsible." And she showed him a piece of paper with a name on it. She told him, "You give this to the police if anything happens to me." But for detectives, of course, Tony was a suspect. He was the only witness, and he had found Sandy, and he made the 911 call. Plus, he was speaking in this calm, cool manner. And now he's immediately pointing the finger at someone else. So this is all raising red flags for them in the beginning. After a team of paramedics worked to try and save her, Sandy lay on a stretcher inside the hospital, naked and bloodied, with an intubation tube in her mouth. She was alive for a short time, but the gunshot wounds were too severe for her to be saved. Sandy Razzo's worst fear was that she was going to be killed before she had a chance to testify in Humphrey's rape case. So she knew this was a possibility. And now she was dead. Police back at the scene locked the townhome down. The police department learned upon arriving at the scene that Sandy had a young daughter, and they needed to secure the home and search and make sure the daughter wasn't there, and then they had to canvass the neighborhood.
Yeah, they needed to knock on doors and try to find out whatever they could. What type of man was Tony Ponikal? Who would want Sandy dead? Did anyone see her pulling into the garage, and were there any suspicious characters hanging around at the time Sandy came home? All good questions. Tony locked up the house and sped away from the scene, following Sandy in the ambulance. Investigators looked at this as a bit suspicious, but at the same time, Tony was understandably concerned about Sandy, and locking up was just a habit. Nothing suspicious there.
No, they'll figure that out, but it did take some time. Sandy's mother, Sandra Poole, showed up at Bayfront Medical Center early on that morning of July 6th, after getting woken by the call that Sandy had been hurt and was in critical condition. Sandra walked around the ER waiting room, and there was a real sadness and fatigue in her voice as she talked to the detectives. She told them the same name that Tony had given them. She said, "Humphrey killed my daughter." She said he threatened to kill Sandy and my granddaughter if she told anyone about the rape and attack. During those 2 days Sandy was held captive, Humphrey got hold of all of Sandy's credit cards, personal information, and family contact information. So Sandy had feared for her life and her family's lives at the time of her murder.
Yeah, and when the investigators looked into Humphrey's past, most of the charges against him were from women being abused, or violence against women, or threatening women, or even telling several women that he would kill them, definitely after the women.
Real problem with women.
Back in 1998, Humphrey had barricaded himself in a house and wouldn't turn himself in. Now, the warrant they had for his arrest was for an alleged kidnapping and aggravated battery against a girlfriend. So sheriffs had surrounded the house, and they shot tear gas into the house through the windows and dragged him out.
So that was serious. Very serious.
Very. Humphrey enjoyed getting physical with women. He liked to control them. He liked to tell them to do things for him.
Absolutely.
He had an ex-wife who was really deathly afraid of him.
Yeah, those detectives will hear some stories, that's for sure.
I'll bet.
Sandy's former co-workers said that she was dependable, but that she did mostly keep her personal life private. Still, some of them shared stories of what had been on Sandy's mind in the weeks before her murder. They knew that she'd been the victim of a rape kidnapping by Humphrey, and detectives asked everyone she knew about Tony Ponikal. But he was soon cleared of suspicions. He'd been cooperative. Tony was willing to give police his fingerprints and DNA to eliminate him forensically. Clearly a guy with nothing to hide. So the police went to talk to Humphrey to get his alibi. He had a good reason to want Sandy dead. So the police department needed to hear from him. They needed to know what he was doing at the time Sandy was murdered. The Brandon Athletic Club where he worked was in a strip mall, and he'd been a personal trainer at the gym for a while now. He seemed popular with the female customers at the club, and he had a way of working himself into the lives of the women he was training. They found out from him that he had married Ashley 3 days earlier, just 1 day before the murder. He refused to talk, saying he wanted to help, but they'd have to go through his attorney. And he even wrote down his attorney's name and number on a piece of paper and gave it to the detectives, so they left with really not finding out anything.
The prosecutor who had been working the sexual assault case against Humphrey was really shocked to hear that Sandy had been killed. She believed that it had to be done in retaliation for Sandy's testimony in the upcoming sexual assault trial. There just wasn't any other motive for someone who wants Sandy dead.
Exactly. But the weapon used in the murder, a .22 caliber Ruger semi-automatic pistol, made investigators think of a hired killer. The small caliber weapon had bullets break apart easily upon impact with bones. And during the deposition on the assault and rape, Humphrey's attorney described Sandy and Humphrey's relationship as consensual and described the rape and confinement as just part of their relationship. It was a situation all made up by Sandy, he said. But Humphrey was really living in his own fantasy world. He was a psychopathic stalker, not just with Sandy, but with most of his former lovers or women who he thought he wanted as a lover.
You know, that case, which was scheduled for trial in June 2003, ended up being postponed to August, just weeks before Sandy was murdered. If convicted, Humphrey could be in prison for 10 years. He had told several people that he couldn't do another day in prison, that he would even kill himself first. But now, with Sandy murdered and unable to testify against him, prosecutors had no choice but to drop the charges.
So at least in the short term, this had worked.
It had. He's a free man.
Yep. So the evidence was leading investigators to Tracy Humphrey, of course. But he'd lawyered up, so getting information from him was difficult. But then they found out that Humphrey was actually bisexual. He'd lived with the guy as a gay couple just a short time before he met Sandy. The one thing that came up from investigating his former life in Miami was that Humphrey had lived with a male hairstylist, and it seemed that he had gotten along much better with the men in his life. Humphrey's changing sexual choices helped investigators to develop a theory that he was fighting against his own homosexuality. Because of this, he acted out violently against women who mentioned anything about his behavior being gay. So, for example, Humphrey liked to go to the mall and shop with Sandy and the girlfriends. So on one occasion, Sandy told him that he would make a good gay friend, and this did not go over well with him, and he held that against her.
I'll bet.
So that's a big theory for someone to come up with who hasn't psychologically examined him. But that's what they were thinking.
Well, they spoke with a male lover that Humphrey had lived with. The police spoke with a male lover that Humphrey had lived with. And this guy said that he had met Humphrey in Miami in 1995 at a gay bar. They had slept together, and the relationship lasted 2 to 4 months. And the man said Humphrey had never shown any signs of being violent with him.
But I mean, on the other hand, women are easier to victimize generally if they're smaller and not as strong.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So Dr. Noel Ascanapalma was the pathologist responsible for completing the autopsy of Sandy Razzo. He discovered that one of the wounds to her head had caused extensive craniocerebral injuries, which means that one of the bullets went through her brain and it was a fatal injury. According to Palma, Sandy had a heartbeat for about an hour after she'd been found bleeding to death inside her car. Palma told Paul that he found abrasions of the skin at the area where some of the entrance gunshot wounds to Sandy's body had been located. So this could be due to an object being between the gun and the target, and that was likely the glass of the car window. The bullet hit the window first, then penetrated Sandy's body, so this meant the window was shattered by the bullet. And this could be important as a detail that only the killer would know. Several of the gunshots would not have been fatal at the time of the shooting either. Those injuries could have been survivable on their own with immediate medical intervention. But after the autopsy, investigators knew that Sandy had pulled into her garage, turned, saw someone come up to the driver's side window, and reacted. She likely knew the person, or knew that the person was trying to kill her, because she did try and scramble away. This was a really cold-blooded killing because Sandy's killer just stood there and repeatedly shot her.
Now, on July 16th, detectives finally went out to the athletic club in Brandon to talk to Humphrey's new young wife, the lovely Ashley. Maybe she knew something and maybe she would be more willing to talk to them. A source had told them that the wedding happened on the 4th of July, just one day before the murder, and detectives were learning that Humphrey and Ashley were married at the Brandon Athletic Club with no rings and no honeymoon. They wondered if Ashley was pregnant, so Ashley could either provide an alibi or provide information to prove Humphrey was behind Sandy's killing.
Right. Well, when detectives showed up at Ashley's apartment that she shared with Humphrey, she answered the door and she was home alone. She let the detectives in and agreed to talk, but she was visibly nervous, shaking. She even vomited while they were there. and according to Ashley, she and Humphrey were home on the night of July 5th. She said they rented movies, ate pizza, and hung out with a female friend named Toby White. While they were there, Ashley took a phone call, and then a few minutes later, Humphrey showed up and came storming into the apartment. He stood next to Ashley as she spoke to the detectives, and he was clearly worked up and angry about detectives talking to her. One of the detectives said his head was bright purple. He was so enraged. So he ended their interview with Ashley, saying that they would have to contact their attorney. But detectives had gotten a name from Ashley, and they felt certain that she knew more than she was telling them.
The day following that short interview with Ashley, detectives began to work on her story. So first they went to the Hollywood Video Store, where Ashley said she and Humphrey had rented movies. So checking on their computer, one of the clerks found that the last known rented movies by Ashley were on June 29th, and the movies were brought back on July 1st. The movies they had rented were Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Punch Drunk Love, and Eyes Wide Shut. Certainly interesting choices.
Yeah. But there was no record of her renting a movie over that holiday weekend, and no record of Tracy Humphrey renting any movies at all. So that really didn't check out.
Then a woman did call the police to say that she had some important info about Sandy's movie.
About Sandy's murder.
Detectives headed over to the woman's house and found her pretty shaken up. She said she knew Tracy Humphrey, and that someone had told her he was dating Sandy Razzo. When she heard Sandy's name in the news, she thought she had information to help. This was a woman who had been married to Tracy Humphrey years earlier, and they'd had a daughter together. The last time she had seen him was on June 29th for Father's Day. But Humphrey had been a terrible husband. He had threatened his wife more than once. He told her that if she ever contacted the police about his violence, he would kill her.
Yeah, so she could see how he might have killed Sandy. To hear these same words from several different sources really helped detectives put together a case against Humphrey. It would also help to convince the state attorney's office to press charges against him. It just wasn't credible that Humphrey just had a bunch of women in his past making up stories. But all of the women would need to be vetted and interviewed more than once before they were considered reliable. So detectives also went to the manager of the Pizza Hut, where the pizza had been delivered from on the night of the murder, and they spoke to the manager. Pizza Hut kept really detailed records of the deliveries its drivers had made. Humphrey ordered pizza on July 5th at about 10:49 p.m., so Humphrey couldn't have been at the scene of Sandy's killing at the time she was killed, and get a pizza at his apartment at the same time. It's like a half an hour away. The manager gave them the cell phone number that the pizza was ordered from, and this was Humphrey's cell phone. They had ordered two pizzas. One was a large hand-tossed chicken and black olives and tomato, and the other was a large pan pizza with the same toppings. So what they really wanted to do was speak with the delivery driver and see who had answered the door. The driver just happened to be there when the detective showed up, and this was a young kid who was very cooperative. They wanted to learn from him who had answered the door, who was in the home, and if there was anything else he'd noticed. And the kid did remember that delivery. He'd had to call the cell phone number on the ticket because they hadn't given them their apartment number. And it was a man who answered the cell phone. The man told him to go to apartment C. When he got there, it was a tall, bulky, bald man who answered the door, and he invited the delivery guy in and asked him to put the pizza on a table. He also paid with a credit card, so it seems like he was making every effort to be remembered and have evidence of this. But he remembered the bald man was the only person there, and he also got a $20 tip, which is unusual.
Yeah, I would remember that. Right?
Yes, right. And when they showed him a picture of Tracy Humphrey, the delivery guy was able to identify him as the man that was at the apartment. So the alibi checked out.
So far, so good.
Yep.
So then that tip came in from the fire department. They told homicide detectives that they found Ashley's car on fire in Tampa about a month before Sandy's murder. Ashley had reported it stolen. Now, investigators had suspected arson, and so they did a background check on Ashley, which showed some odd purchases. Ashley bought two computer software programs which helped her look for people. One of them was a search, paid for with her credit card.
Ashley's co-signer on her car loan was David Abernathy, her mother's boyfriend. Detectives spoke with Abernathy and had a big break in the case. He had loaned his gun to Ashley, and shell casings from his gun, a Ruger .22 caliber, matched the type found in Sandy's garage after her murder. Detectives also found out that Ashley had gone to a gun range and practiced shooting back on June 1st, the same day her car had been found burned out. But no one knew what was in that car that Ashley and Humphrey wanted to destroy. This was a new VW Beetle, which Ashley loved. She was making payments on it.
Yeah, must have been something wrong with it.
Yes.
So after examining Ashley's cell phone records, she ended up becoming the primary suspect, although Humphrey was the one who was directing her. Her cell phone pinged off the antenna near Sandy's workplace, the Green Iguana, and then moved to Pinellas County, where Sandy lived. Just minutes after the murder, the phone pinged in Pinellas Park. So this put Ashley in Sandy's neighborhood at the time of the killing. And with this as evidence, detectives arrested Ashley for Sandy Razzo's murder.
Well, at first, Ashley refused to talk or deny her involvement. She actually seemed like kind of a tough cookie for a young woman like that. But after 3 weeks in jail, she confessed to the murder. Her motive, she said, was to keep Tracy Humphrey out of prison. Detectives learned that a few weeks before, Ashley borrowed the .22 from her mom's boyfriend. She had stolen a rifle from their house. And with that rifle, she followed Sandy, wearing different disguises. She painted her face black and wore oversized clothing. And 1 month before going through with the murder, she drove her Beetle to the parking lot where Sandy worked. She sat in that car for hours. And when Sandy left work, Ashley pointed the gun out of her car window, disguising it in a pair of blue jeans. She closed her eyes and pulled the trigger. Sandy heard the report and she ducked, but she didn't know it was a gunshot. So she got into her car and drove away, but Ashley then saw that she'd shot right through her own rearview mirror. And she didn't realize that the barrel was set lower than the scope, which, according to gun experts, I guess that's a common beginner's mistake. And so the barrel had actually gone through that mirror.
Yeah, I guess we need a different gun.
And if it hadn't done that, she may have killed Sandy that day. But apparently Humphrey was livid with her. She panicked and threw the gun into the woods from the highway, drove to a vacant lot, and set her car on fire. Now, if she came up with this on her own, I really can't go with the idea that he brainwashed her or threatened her into doing this. Because that's really criminal behavior to just go set your car on fire.
Uh-huh.
Why wouldn't you just take a bat and break the mirror off? Anyway,
who
stupid.
Knows?
Yeah. Well, later on, she reported her car stolen, and she borrowed her mom's boyfriend's gun. Humphrey wanted to get rid of Sandy, but he knew he'd be caught if he did it himself. So he knew he had to get someone else to do it for him. In Florida, a spouse cannot be compelled to speak against another, or testify against another. So he married Ashley the day before the murder. And that probably was the reason.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
You just don't believe in love, do you?
I hate to be a skeptic, but this couple has issues.
Yeah, so police were pretty certain that Humphrey was the mastermind of Sandy's murder. But they still needed more evidence to arrest him. So Toby White agreed to wear a wire and talk to Humphrey. In this discussion, Humphrey asked Toby to lie to the police for him and say she was with Ashley and Tracy when the murder took place.
Well, yeah, now he was really kind of threatening her because he and Ashley moved into her apartment and she felt like she couldn't leave the house, like he was keeping an eye on her.
Right.
So I can see that it was a good thing she went to the police and agreed to work with them. She got what he was saying on tape. So the tape, the cell phone records, and his arrest history, and his history with Sandy and other women, added up to enough evidence to arrest him. In the phone records, it was revealed that Ashley and Tracy Humphrey called each other 22 times on the night of the murder. So Humphrey was arrested, and he was charged with first-degree murder.
Yeah, so Ashley and Humphrey were both in prison awaiting trial. And in February 2006, prosecutors made a deal with Ashley. If she pled guilty, and testified against Humphrey. The state would ask for a 25-year sentence for her instead of the death penalty.
But then Humphrey's attorney was insisting that Ashley had done this on her own. The prosecutor said that Tracy Humphrey's a violent and manipulative man. He'd used Ashley and Toby White to do his bidding. Toby testified that after the murder, he threatened to kill her if he found out she was working with the police. In Ashley's testimony, she said that she had quickly fallen in love with Humphrey. But soon he was controlling and very intimidating. She couldn't go anywhere without telling him, and she wasn't even allowed to have any friends. He began hitting her and threatening to throw her out on the street. One night he hit her so hard, she said, that she was unconscious, and when she woke up, she begged him not to leave her or kick her out, and then she had agreed to kill Sandy for him. And he agreed with that, so I can only think he wanted her to say that.
Well, yeah.
And on the other hand, she could have been making some of this up to make herself look more innocent.
Sure.
So it's hard to know exactly how that worked. But once she had agreed to kill Sandy, she said that Humphrey was the one making the plans. It was his idea of how to get the gun, to follow Sandy, and to wear the ridiculous disguise. When her first murder attempt had failed, according to Ashley, Humphrey was very enraged with her. He told her that she had to kill Sandy or he wouldn't be with her anymore. And she went through with it to keep him out of prison, believing his lies about Sandy's assault and rape charges being false. And I don't know how strongly she believed that if she was being abused by him. She should have considered it might have been true.
You would think.
Also, if he was innocent, why was he so convinced he'd be convicted? But when Humphrey's defense attorney asked her why she had murdered Sandy, she said, "Because I loved him."
Yeah, still, Tracy Humphrey insisted that Ashley had come up with the plan to kill Sandy on her own. He said that all he wanted her to do for him was find some dirt on Sandy. The jury didn't believe him. They only deliberated for 4 hours before they found him guilty of first-degree murder. And a couple days later, he was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Ashley will likely be released from prison when she's in her mid-40s, assuming she stays out of trouble in prison.
Yeah, in the Killer Women show, I believe that it said she'd be out in 2028, so it's not that far off, really. So I don't know how I feel about that. It's really hard to say. Although if I had to have one of them come out and be free, I think I'd pick her. I think he's the scarier. But who knows? She could be a total psychopath tricking us all.
I'm not so sure about her. So.
Yeah.
But that's the deal they got.
Yes. So Sandy Razzo's remembered by friends and family as a petite, beautiful woman with a sweet, gentle personality and a really charming sense of humor. She's also a hero to many who believe her death and the conviction of Tracy Humphrey have saved other women from becoming his victims. But, of course, it would be a lot better if she could have just testified and had him taken off the streets that way. It's really sad that she died for this. And her daughter doesn't have a mom. So how do we feel about Ashley? I'm feeling like she was only 20, and it's very possible that this man could have really messed with her brain and got her to do things she wouldn't normally do. But then, on the other side, this dozing off in the car and wanting her pizza, I don't know, I bet if we talk to a psychologist, there's a reason for that as well. So it's a fascinating idea. And I think we can give her some empathy based on her upbringing, her age, and her being controlled and manipulated by this older man. But we certainly can't say that she's innocent. She stood there and shot Sandy over and over again. So some examples of people being brainwashed into murder. What about Billy Flynn, who killed Pam Smart's husband, Greg Smart? Pam had told Billy that Greg was abusive and that she wanted him to kill Greg for her. And he did it.
Yes, he did.
And I just remember seeing him cry on the stand, and I did feel some empathy for him. He did seem pretty destroyed by what he'd done. But how do we treat these people? Do we treat them as if it was their own idea to do it, or do we need to make other allowances?
I don't want to make any other allowances.
Okay. So you think that Ashley is just as guilty as Tracy Humphrey?
Yeah, I'll give her some points for being younger and having lived a terrible life, but still.
Yes, but she really didn't have her own personal motive for killing Sandy, unless she did it just to keep Humphrey. I don't know if I can believe that.
I know. See?
But she absolutely went through with it and needed to go to prison.
Yes, she did.
But, you know, there are a few people who have said, well, Humphrey had nothing to do with it. Ashley did it on her own, and then she decided to blame him. I think even Pierce Morgan on that Killer Women interview was implying something like that. Like, how do we know she didn't just do it all on her own? And I don't believe that to be true.
Well, I think there's too many things that have to be in play for that to be a viable reason.
Yes, and I think there's enough evidence to show his involvement.
Yeah.
Or maybe even him masterminding it.
Yep, I do.
Yeah. So our sources for this case are the Killer Women interview I mentioned earlier with Pierce Morgan, interviewing Ashley Humphrey. There's a book titled Kill For Me, written by M. Willem Phelps. There is a Snapped episode, and we also have the Pinellas County Court documents. So there's a lot of stuff out there on this case. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you have any comments, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Or you could go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and write your comments there. Or even better, leave us a voicemail. Then your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we'd really love to hear from you. There is a widget on our website in the upper right corner where you can click and record your voicemail. And I'll also put a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail. We really do like to hear from our listeners. If you're interested in getting your future TCB episodes commercial-free, getting an extra episode every month, and getting a free gift, you might want to consider subscribing as a Tie Grabber at tiegrabber.com. You can go there and just hit subscribe and see what your choices are. Also, if you enjoy the show, we'd really appreciate it if you'd leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. And if you don't enjoy the show, don't bother leaving a review.
Well, if there's constructive criticism.
Yeah, but you can send that directly to us. There's no reason to share that with others. That can be just between us and them.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, Dickie, what'd you bring for feedback today?
I got some feedback. I got a couple voicemails and one email. And the first voicemail is from Elizabeth, and she's just making a comment.
Good morning, Dick and Jill. My name is Elizabeth Pritchard, and I'm one of your Canadian listeners. Wanted to let you know how much I look forward to your podcast every week, particularly if they're Canadian. I'd like to point out, though, about your Canadian beer reviews. I think that you liked one called Vin du Monde from Chambly, Quebec. Some people might pronounce it Vin du Monde. And I think you liked that one, but I can't remember you being particularly excited about any other Canadian beers. One of the things that we as Canadians do is when we pour our beer, we make sure that there's no head on it or very little. And I don't know why it is, but it seems to be a tradition from Post. So I wanted to suggest that when you are drinking a Canadian beer, try pouring it like that so that it is very Canadian. I'm looking forward to your next podcast and have a great day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Elizabeth. So this is mostly focused on you, Dick. What have you got to say for yourself?
Well, I did like Le Fin du Monde. It's brewed by Unibrew, is the brewery in Chambly. They make a lot of good beers. And if we have other Canadian cases, I would probably do one of those because they're excellent. I have done other Canadian beers. Most of them are lagers that aren't particularly attractive or very good. So Molson, Moosehead, things like that. Yeah.
Well, maybe some more Canadian listeners could give you some more recommendations.
I'm always looking for recommendations.
All right. Awesome. Hey, we have one more voicemail from Vicky.
Vicky, she has a comment for us also. And she suggested a case.
Hi, this is Vicky, a Californian living in West Virginia. I truly enjoy your show for many reasons. Having worked in healthcare 40 years, I appreciate the medical perspective of each crime. I also enjoy the social perspective, particularly the musing of how and why choices were made by the persons involved. other true crime podcasts don't often consider why a person becomes a victim or a perpetrator. Further, I appreciate the discussion rather than just providing information. I confess that I have listened to several of the same podcasts more than once, and I certainly appreciate the beer tasting. I enjoyed different beers, and Dick has opened up some ideas for me to try. Although I prefer a good Hefeweizen, I get a kick out of Dick choosing a beer from the region that the crime takes place. I find the stories intriguing, but I also find your voices soothing and often listen to your podcasts when I have difficulty falling asleep. I am requesting a podcast on Michael and Elizabeth Turpin. Rena Vecini has written a book called Fatal Seduction that describes their relationship, Elizabeth's manipulation of others, and the murder. This murder hits close to home. I lived within a couple miles of the apartment complex at which Michael was murdered. I also attended the University of Kentucky and find it incomprehensible that a young, attractive student with a wonderful husband would resort to murder for her own gain. Thank you very much for your podcasts and for your time. Enjoy the day.
Thanks so much, Vicky. Vicky had this together. There must have been an outline. She had it very laid out, what she wanted to say.
Stuck to her plan.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting case.
Michael Turpin.
Michael Turpin, I think he was like 22 years old when he was stabbed to death in 1986. Now, eventually it turned out that his wife's girlfriend, and the person that they hired to kill Michael were convicted of his murder.
So why did they want to kill this young guy?
Well, I need to do a little more research, but it looks like they killed him because his wife didn't want to be with him. She was in love with the girlfriend. She was under the influence of drugs, been using things for that, and they ended up killing him for the $60,000 life insurance policy.
Well, that's incredibly sad.
Isn't that sad?
It really is, yeah. And if I could just quickly address what Vicky had said about listening to an episode more than once, and when she's trying to fall asleep. I mean, that's something I do a lot of. There are certain podcasts that are just my favorite, and I've probably heard episodes several times, the same episode. But I think what it is, even if you know what they're going to say, it's like these people you listen to so much, you feel like they're friends of yours. When you're falling asleep, it's just kind of comforting to hear voices that just feel friendly and secure. So it's kind of funny how podcasts work that way.
Or we could just be boring and sleep-inducing.
Well, to a certain extent, but I think there's comfort in hearing the same voices over and over.
Yeah.
So I think that we could more attribute that to the comfort than to us being so fascinated she'd want to hear us talk about the same thing twice.
I'll do that.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Okay, and we have one email I'll have you read.
An email from Jessica. This is a case suggestion. Dear Dick and Jill, huge fan. I'm really hoping for you guys to do an episode on Stephen Pladel, I think, P-L-A-D-L. He and his wife had a daughter in high school and placed the baby girl up for adoption. The couple later married and had three more daughters. Now, years later, the daughter they had given up found them and actually moved in with them. And then she began having an incestuous relationship with her biologic father. So the wife found out about this. She kicked him out.
Good move.
Authorities were notified when a baby was born from this twisted union, and medical staff could tell the child had features of incest.
Now, what does that mean, features of incest?
I don't know, unless there was some weird inherited thing. So the sick people eventually married, and shockingly, the adoptive parents and Stephen's mother attended the ceremony.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It gets worse. I don't know all the details because the case didn't get a lot of media coverage.
That's shocking.
The baby that they had was placed in the care of Stephen's mother. And I think the adoptive parents were trying to get their daughter away from her monstrous husband / father.
Yeah.
So Stephen murdered the baby and hid him away in a closet. Then he shot his wife,
who was also his daughter,
and her adoptive father before turning the gun on himself. I would love to know about Stephen's upbringing and what kind of environment such a disgusting person comes from. Looking forward to hearing all about it from you two. Thanks, Jessica.
I'd say this is just an all-around tragedy.
Oh, isn't it?
Yes.
It's one of those things that you say, truth is stranger than fiction.
This is like a whole new level of dysfunction.
Isn't it?
Yes.
So we'll look into that.
Absolutely. It sounds fascinating. It reminds me just on how awful and deranged it is of that Sugar Babe case.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was that called? It was the girl that was beaten to death. They called her Sugar Babe. There was a documentary.
Yeah. It's
Good Night, Sugar Babe.
Railroad Tracks, something like that.
Yeah, I had nightmares about that one. Well, I will definitely look into that because as tragic as it is, it does sound really interesting.
It does.
I have to admit, yeah.
It's like one of those horror films or some horror thing. You're scared as hell or disgusted as heck, but you keep watching it because you are interested.
Right, like the whole, you can't help but turn your head when you pass by a car accident, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jessica. And thank you, everyone, for sending us your feedback. I hope we get more this week.
We're looking good.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll save a place.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.